Aprendimos a quererte desde la histórica altura.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Che, the song, or Hasta Siempre Comandante, to introduce Lisa Sullivan, a community organizer originally from Virginia who has spent most of her life working in Venezuela. Lisa Sullivan's story epitomizes those I love to air on Raising Sand Radio, as it brings to a wider audience the everyday goodness of people doing extraordinary things in big ways and in small ways, and connects humanity through our caring for our fellow man. I recorded Lisa Sullivan during a presentation for students at Holy Names College in Oakland, California last week. She discusses events unfolding in Honduras and how she came to be involved with the School of the Americas Watch. Before we turn it over to Lisa Sullivan, let me remind you that the School of the Americas at the SOA was in 2001 renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, and it's a combat training school for Latin American soldiers located at Fort Benning, Georgia. Initially established in Panama in 1946, it was kicked out of that country in 1984 under the terms of the Panama Canal Treaty. Over its 59 years, the School of the Americas has trained over 60,000 Latin American soldiers in counterinsurgency techniques, sniper training, commando and psychological warfare, military intelligence, and interrogation tactics. These graduates have consistently used their skills to wage a war against their own people. Among those targeted by School of the America graduates are educators, union organizers, religious workers, student leaders, and others who work for the rights of the poor. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, massacred, and forced into refuge by those trained at the School of the Americans, which is also often dubbed the School of Assassins. There is an annual gathering outside the School of the Americas in Georgia, in Fort Benning in Georgia, and Lisa will talk about that event and what you should know about it.
I'm going to share a little bit about my perspective of this School of the Americas, but also about my perspective of our neighbors, Latin America, our neighbors to the south, which are many millions of people very nearby, but often we don't hear much about them in our newspapers. I've been in Latin America for 32 years, which I never would have imagined. I actually first went to Latin America when I was the age of many of you all. I was 20 years old and decided to take a Spanish course that my college offered. And the great thing was that they offered it in Mexico. So, of course, who's not going to want to take the course in Mexico? I got there by train. I took a bus to the border and then got on the train and a long 24-hour train ride. And in that train ride, something happened to me that to this day I can't explain, but I fell deeply, surprisingly, amazingly, head over heels in love, not with a person, but with a country, a culture, a language, everything. I just felt it pulling me in. It was a total surprise. My course came to the end. I actually learned a lot of Spanish because I hung out with the Mexicans, and that's how you learn, by actually practicing it. And along with my fellow students, we took the train and then took the bus back, the Greyhound bus, once we got to the border. It took me 7 days to get back home in Virginia. And I told my family that I really wanted to go back. I felt like something was calling me. And they said, okay, surprisingly. So I got on that same bus and same train, went back, taught English, did what I could for a while. It's interesting how one little thing can sometimes change our lives. And for me, it was a letter. I was having breakfast at the home of a Mexican family where I was staying. And at that home was staying a sister of mercy from Connecticut who was learning Spanish to go back and work with Latinos, Hispanics in Connecticut. And I was planning to go back maybe 2 or 3 days back to the U.S. I'd been the summer in Mexico, but knew I had to go back. I had to get back for my semester. I hadn't finished college. And she said, could I read you this letter? And I said, well, sure. So she had just received this letter from a fellow Mercy sister, Sister Caridad, from Connecticut, who was living in a little village of Chanmagua in Guatemala. And she went on to describe what was happening in her little village, a very poor village of farmers. And she said that many of the people, especially some of the students and some of those who were teaching religious education the weekends and the evenings with the youth were being, the military was coming into the town and was taking them away. And she was often walking 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours to the nearest towns to find where they were. In some cases, she found them in jail and was able to bring them back. In some cases, she didn't know what had happened to them. And I remember thinking, what would a religious ed teacher say that a military person would take them away, you know, and take somebody away? So more out of intrigue than anything else, I said, well, you know, what, could I go there? And she said, well, there's no phone, or, you know, there's, yeah, here it is on the map. Here's the name of the town. So I literally found a map, found the town, and I probably shouldn't share this part, but I actually hitchhiked all the way to Guatemala, not to get the idea to do it yourselves, but found my way to this little town and arrived at the, by this point at the back of a truck. And out of this little adobe church, when this truck arrived many days later, this middle-aged sister came out and stretched her arms to me. She had no idea who I was. I mean, there was no letters, there was no fax, there was no way of getting mail there. To this day, I'll always remember that sense of welcome. She didn't know who I was. What did I have to do to offer there? But this sense of welcome. She knew for some reason I felt called to come. I stayed in that village only 3 months, but when you're 20, at least it felt like for me when I'm 20, 20 felt like it went on for like 30 years. It was like a long time. So 3 months when I was 20 felt like a long time. And many things, my whole ground beneath my feet began to move in those months. It was a very poor town. People lived in one-room little homes, often made of mud, but people of great generosity. Almost every morning, we would wake up at 5 a.m. to find on our table a stack of tortillas, often a recently killed chicken for breakfast. And so on and so forth. Just tremendous generosity, but people had so little. We tried to be helpful. I remember going to the fields and trying to plant, and the fields were vertical. You know, it was almost impossible to stand up, much less to plant. And so to admire the hard work that they did in such difficult conditions. Well, every evening they would gather in their little chapel to say the rosary or to pray. And then once every Sunday, they would come to the chapel for Mass. And since it was such a remote village, the priest would only come through once a year. He'd come through and marry everybody who needed to get married and baptize and confirm and head on his way. So what they would do instead of the priest, they put out a little very simple wooden table and at the center of it put a little cloth and would put a radio on the table. And I remember the first Mass thinking, that's kind of weird. There's no priest, there's a radio. And the Mass was said by the bishop of the neighboring little country of El Salvador. We were right on the border. And it was a bishop named Oscar Romero who had newly been put in the position of bishop. And he began to speak about what was happening in El Salvador, which was very similar to what was happening in Guatemala, where I was. People were disappearing. Student leaders and labor union leaders, people in their communities who were organizing, again, religious ed teachers, sisters, and so on, were either being disappeared or many times were being brutally killed. And so on the radio, he would talk about this and would talk about how this cannot happen. I remember not really understanding his words. To understand Spanish by radio is hard when you're learning, but I could understand the reaction of the people in this town and could tell that he was speaking directly to their hearts in denouncing this. Well, as I said, the ground really began to shift under my feet, and one thing led to another, and I felt a call somehow to stay in Latin America. It's almost like when you find yourself turning 180 degrees, you don't really know why. I had no idea what I would do or what I had to offer. But I felt that call, and I felt that call specifically in some way through the Catholic Church that in such a brave way was standing up to what was happening, was denouncing it. I went on to find other ways to be in Latin America and ended up staying for 32 years. But what did happen to Monsignor Romero, he continued to denounce the kind of atrocities he was witnessing in his country. He began to get threats himself. He began to get threats to say, you'd better stop saying this, or you are the one who's going to be the next victim. And he knew that this was clearly a possibility, but it made him only speak up more and more. Now, he was somebody who, when he became bishop, was hardly a radical. He was known as basically a paper pusher. And yet what he saw happening around him really called him to take a stand. One day, March 23rd, 1980, he gave a homily, his homily he would give on the radio, in which he directed his words to the military of El Salvador. And he said, I now want to call on you, the soldiers, the guardsmen of El Salvador. And he said, in the face of a command from the military commander to kill your brothers and sisters is a higher command of God that says, do not kill. And he said, I beseech you, I ask you, I demand of you, lay down your arms, let there be no more repression. Cease the repression. And so he gave this homily on March 23rd, and the next day when he was giving a smaller mass, he was murdered while giving the mass. It was later determined that the person responsible for calling for the murder of Monsignor Romero was a graduate of a school that was just mentioned. It's a military training school called the School of the Americas. The School of the Americas is run by the U.S. Army. It's paid for by you and me, at least those of us who pay taxes, or your parents. We fund the School of the Americas. And it has trained soldiers from Latin America for almost 60 years. As atrocities began to take place in Latin America, such as the murder of Monsignor Romero, also the murder of four church women shortly thereafter in El Salvador, four church women who'd been working in a very poor community and were returning from a meeting. Their jeep was abducted. They were taken, raped, and murdered. This was an atrocity that many people were shocked by. After this took place, there was a Marianal priest named Father Roy Bourgeois who was friends with these sisters. And he began to look into what had led to the deaths of his friends. And again, the line led to those responsible for their murders had graduated from the School of the Americas. And so he wanted to find out more about this school. But many people in the United States had not heard of this school, even though we had trained so many people. So he decided to take an action, which perhaps was unusual, not your typical thing that a priest would do, but he felt called by faith to take action against this school. And so he knew that the Salvadorans were training in a certain barracks at this school. It's located in Fort Benning, Georgia. And he wanted to appeal to their hearts. And so he entered the base. He bought at the military army surplus store, bought a military uniform, and sewed on the name Romero. He went in with two companions, one sewed in the name of, I think it was Ida Ford, one of the Marianal sisters, and the other one with the name of Father Rutilio Grande, a Jesuit priest who'd been killed. But they sewed on their names without anybody really noticing what names were there, and went to the gates of Fort Benning and saluted, and they let him in as though they knew what they were doing. They went to the back of the base and waited till nightfall, and once it was dark, they simply climbed up a tree. They climbed up a tree and they were carrying a boombox. And once the lights went out in the barracks where the Salvadoran soldiers were training, they pressed the play button. And out of the tree boomed the voice of Monsignor Oscar Romero, the bishop who had recently been murdered. His voice recorded in the homily in which he calls out to the soldiers of El Salvador to lay down the arms, to cease the repression. So out of the tree comes this voice, which of course these soldiers knew this voice. Well, they got a reaction right away. The military came, shining lights, pulling them down with dogs, billy clubs. Father Roy was then sentenced to 2 years in jail. He knew that this was going to be likely something like this would happen. And he did this knowing that this action would perhaps lead to going to jail. Did it knowing that in this way he would shine a light on this school. People would say, oh, what did that priest go to jail for? So people are going to try to find out, and by finding out, they're going to realize that this school existed. And so more and more people began to find out that this school existed and began to investigate, began to ask for the names of those who'd graduated from this school, and got a list of thousands of names, and meanwhile began to investigate the thousands, tens of thousands of massacres that were taking place in Latin America in these years, entire villages that were murdered. And the crossover kept happening. This graduate here was the one responsible for this murder. And on again. It became clear that this wasn't just an exception. This was what was being trained at this school. And so movement began to form in a very small way. A group of 10 people gathered to say, in front of the gates of Fort Benning, to say, we're going to fast for many days to call attention to this school. That was quite a few years ago. Well, only last year, instead of 10 people gathering at the gates of Fort Benning, 20,000 people gathered at the gates of Fort Benning. And that is a result of just sharing the story, sharing the story. Some people asked Father Roy, how did you create this big movement? And he said, there are no shortcuts. You just share the story of these lives, and others share that story. And that's how we become aware. And when we become aware, we feel called to take a stand. And so to come to the gates of Fort Benning. So as this movement was growing, I was leading my own life in Latin America. I joined Maryknoll as a lay missioner. I had 3 children, and we worked in Bolivia and then in Venezuela. I've actually been in Venezuela for 25 years. Venezuela is also a very interesting country with a very different perspective in our newspapers than what actually takes place down there. But raised my children in a barrio, in a house, a cinder block house with a tin roof. The only bathroom my ever kids knew was outside. Was normal. It's what everybody had, a bathroom outside. We lived very simply. Didn't have TV channels, had a dirt road. Our water came out of a barrel. But we had an abundance of many other things, an abundance of love and community and connection from our neighbors. It's very easy to raise children in this context. There's no such thing as babysitting to pay somebody to babysit. I remember the first time I offered somebody, she was going to cry when she'd help to take care of my kids. It's something that people just do. They're there for one another. And so often people say, well, how did you possibly raise your kids in that way? And I'm like, how could you possibly not raise your kids in that way? How difficult when you aren't surrounded by that community, by that love? And so my kids did grow up there. They're all now finishing graduating college. At one point, I received a phone call from Father Roy Bourgeois asking me if I would help him to work to close this school. Now, he's been working in the U.S. and creating a movement, and one of the things that he did in shining this light on this school was to pressure the government to close the school. He asked many people to ask their member of Congress to close this school, and a legislative bill in Congress was presented, which had many, many people backing it up. And so at that point, the Army realized, wait a minute, there may be enough votes that they're going to close down this school. We don't want this school to close down. And so what they did was to change the name of the school. It was their way of sidestepping. And I was reminded by my friend Seal that this was much of what happened in the 1960s in our country when schools were called to desegregate. There was a list of schools, and they were told by the government, you must now open your doors to people of all races. Well, what many schools did in the South was to change the name of their school, and then they weren't on that list. Okay, so once again, we had a similar situation, a school also in the South, changing its name to avoid being closed. So Father Roy approached me and asked if I would be willing to help him close this school. And he said specifically he wanted to meet with President Chavez of Venezuela, to ask him if he would withdraw Venezuelan troops from the School of the Americas. And I remember this call, and I said, well, that's a great idea. I'd like to meet President Chavez too, but I don't know what I could do for you. I'm a community worker. I was working in a community, working with youth and children. I worked a lot with music. I didn't even live in the capital of the country. But as we know, Roy's a stubborn guy. Someone like that who does crazy things like climbing trees and going to jail doesn't take no easily for an answer. So he said, I'm coming down. Well, let's find a way to get to the president. So Roy came down, and I was in a panic. How do I get to the president? And I did find, actually, a sister, a nun, who knew the vice president. And she said, I'll set up a meeting with the vice president for you. Which I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, I've never sat down with the vice president. So Shirley, Roy came, and we did have a meeting with the vice president of Venezuela. We entered the meeting, and Roy kind of whispered as we were entering, he said, "Lisa, you know, my Spanish is kind of rusty, so could you translate for me?" Now, if any of you know Roy? Roy's English is hard to understand. He's from the Bayou, from Louisiana. He's the only one I know who speaks Spanish with a Bayou accent, so actually, he would not have been understood. So I agreed, "Okay, Roy, I'll translate for you." So we sat down with the vice president and talked about several things, and then at one point, Roy said to the vice president, "We've come to ask you to withdraw Venezuelan troops from the School of the Americas." So I'm translating this request and thinking, oh God, you know, like, who are we, these gringos, to tell head of a government what to do with his military? And feeling like embarrassed, that was just pretty bold. So I kind of mumbled what Roy had said, and the vice president stopped and said, "That is such a good idea." He said, "Do you mean we're still sending troops to this school?" And we said, "We think so." So he asked his aide to actually call the defense minister and confirm it on the spot. He called the defense minister, and he did confirm that Venezuela was still sending troops to this school. Now, the reason why this was quite extraordinary, that they were still sending, was because only 2 years previous to this meeting, there had been a coup in Venezuela to kick out the president. It was actually overturned by the people of Venezuela 2 days later, but the people who organized the coup were two generals who had graduated from the School of the Americas. And so here was this coup, the president was overturned, the people overturned the coup, brought the president back, and yet Venezuela continued to send troops to this school. We later found out that one of the reasons is that they often don't even know who they're sending to this school. And I've found this out time and time again. The reason being that those who run the school don't usually send out just a generic letter to Chile, "Okay, Chile, send us 50 of your best men." They send a letter to Capitán Juan González, you know, Coronel Jorge Rodriguez, inviting them to a course with a very nice name. And so often the governments aren't even aware of who is studying at this school. So the vice president told us that it would be great if the president were aware of this. And he said, "Is there any way I can contact you?" So we gave him our cell phone number and thought, well, okay, here's the number. And as we left the vice president's office, came down the stairs, and there was cameras and lights and microphones. And I guess the assumption is that whoever talks with the vice president must be somebody important, so let's film them. So Roy grabbed the mic, and we talked about, to the cameras, why we were in Venezuela to ask President Chavez to withdraw troops from the School of the Americas. And we gave our little spiel and then left. And we were walking down a busy street in Caracas, and I heard this sound. What is that? And then I realized it was a cell phone. I'd never even used a cell phone until that day, actually, I admit. Opened the cell phone, answered, and the person said, "Lisa, es Jose Vicente." Jose Vicente is the vice president that we just met with. And I'm like, "Oh, hi." He said that the President Chavez had just seen us on TV and wanted to meet with us. Apparently, Chavez watches the new news, and we run the new news. So that led to us being actually invited to meet with Chavez. So indeed, Roy was right. We found a way to get to the president. As always, he finds his way to get in the door. And we did have quite an amazing meeting with President Chavez and shared the story of not the School of the Americas. That's a story which everybody in Latin America knows. Young people such as yourselves, if you ask them what is the School of the Americas, they are all aware of this atrocious history. But what he was not aware of was that so many people, 20,000 people from the U.S., were gathering at the gates of this school to call for its closing. He was not aware of the fact that not only had Roy gone to jail, and at this point Roy had gone to jail a total of 4 years, he later went for other incidents, but 200 people, some of them from here, from the Bay Area, have gone to jail for just crossing a line where this school is located in Fort Benning, Georgia. And so this was very surprising and very moving for the president to hear. It's a very different picture often of the people in the U.S. that perhaps people in Latin America have, just as we have erroneous views often of people in Latin America. And we could sense that this really opened his heart to the issue. He said he would consider the decision, he would get back to us, and indeed a month later, Venezuela announced publicly to the press that they were withdrawing all Venezuelan troops from the School of the Americas, and they would send no more troops. So it was a great moment for this movement, for Roy. Again, he kind of knew where to go and where to push, and that happened. Shortly after that, Roy called me again and said, well, we did it once, we can do it again. Let's keep trying to get to other countries and other presidents, see if they will withdraw. If we can't close the school by legislation, we'll close it by attrition. So it was a pretty ambitious idea. And Roy doesn't even do email. So I don't know what he was thinking, how we were going to get to these folks, except that what he was thinking was I would find a way to help him get to these folks. I was living in Latin America. So in the next several years, we have visited 17 countries, Roy and I and several others who've accompanied us, 17 different countries in Latin America that send troops to this school, and we've also met with 7 presidents. And I always tell people, it's amazing what you can do if you try. You know, if you knock on enough doors, send enough emails, ask somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, but mostly if you really believe in what you're doing, you believe that this idea, this issue really needs to be heard. And I think if you go forward with that idea, it is amazing the doors that do open. And so we have met with 7 presidents, and this has led to 5 countries to announce withdrawal from the school: Venezuela, Uruguay, Argentina, Bolivia, and Costa Rica. So while we haven't totally closed it by attrition, it has been kind of significant to have these countries remove their troops from this school.
This is Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, and we're talking to Lisa Sullivan, who has been traveling around the United States talking about the School of the Americas and its connection to Latin America and Honduras. Lisa goes on to describe the School of the Americas as a window into U.S. policy in Latin America, focusing on how it is playing out in Honduras these days.
The School of the Americas is a window of understanding of all of Latin America. We look at this school and we're able to understand how we as a country, as the United States, have tried to relate to Latin America over centuries in a very not positive way. And what's happened in Honduras in the past 2 months is also a window of understanding of Latin America and also our relations with Latin America. So just briefly, I'll let you know that we had visited Honduras right before this coup took place, and we also went right after the coup took place. And so we've had a very different perspective. When we went to Honduras right before the coup, this was in April and early May, we were able to meet with President Zelaya. We met with him and with a group of people. We thought it might be a meeting of about 10 minutes. It turned out to be a 6-hour-long meeting with a very unusual group of people that you would not expect a president to meet with. It was with a group of leaders, community leaders, the kind of folks that I would meet with. Environmental leaders, human rights leaders, indigenous. Many of them didn't even have shoes, some of the indigenous communities who don't have the tradition of wearing shoes. People who were head of the workers at the port. And so again, people who did community work. And there was a 6-hour dialogue that was one of a series of meetings that he was having with these people. And it became clear that there was a coming to the table of people that often don't come to the table. I think even in our country, it's difficult to imagine a president, perhaps even one as Obama, who worked as a community organizer, having a 6-hour meeting with his fellow community. I mean, I would hope maybe he would, but it was unusual, to say the least. And so it was clear that there was this real desire on the part of the president to be in touch with what's happening at the base. He also shared some of his own changes as a person. Many of us feel like Central America is a place that has changed the heart of many others. As I mentioned earlier, Monsignor Romero, the bishop, he began as a paper pusher. He was not somebody who was going to stir the waters. That's why he was named. But he became so prophetic, so clearly speaking out against the injustices that led to his death. And his death led to thousands, if not millions, of people realizing that our faith must motivate us to do something, to take at least one step. He became a prophet. Well, President Zelaya told us that he himself felt like he was changing since he'd become president. He was elected as someone who was going to keep everything the same, the status quo. And the status quo in the country of Honduras is not a pretty picture. Honduras is the third poorest country in the entire hemisphere. Only Haiti and Bolivia are poorer than it. It's a very small country, but 70% of the people live in poverty. A good number of people are not even able to attend public schools or to have the basics just to eat. And so he was elected as somebody who was one of the business class. Now, the other thing about Honduras is that it's a country in which 10 families own 90% of the business of that country. 90%, and there's lists. These are the 10 families, the lists of all the businesses they own. And so basically these were the buddies of President Zelaya. But he realized once he was president, he wanted to do something to help his country and asked the fellow elites, the fellow business leaders to help him. And he said one after another, they turned him down. But the people who had been trying to achieve change, they didn't turn him down. They really wanted to dialogue about how change could take place. And he said by being with them and listening to them, he began to change himself. And one of those changes was by making a change in the minimum wage. Unlike our country, where minimum wage often doesn't change for many years, right? It's kind of the same for a long time. In many countries of Latin America, every year they decide the minimum wage. And so the labor leaders meet with the business leaders and kind of come to an agreement, and that's established as the minimum wage. But in Honduras that year, it came to an impasse. They couldn't decide, and by law, that goes to the president to decide. And so he said, well, let's think of something pretty basic. He said to his aide, what does it cost for a family of four to eat here in Honduras? And they gave him the statistic. And he said, well, as a minimum, this has to be the minimum wage. At least people need to be able to feed their children. So he declared that as the minimum wage. Well, that turned out to be a 60% increase in the minimum wage, which you can imagine the 10 families that own the 90% of the businesses of the country, how they felt about that. And so he began to take other steps that was clear in a way, perhaps, I don't want to compare him to Monsignor Romero, but somehow his heart was being opened more to how those people who he'd probably never sat at the table with before and realized what their lives were like. And more than anything, people felt connected to him, the fact that he was listening to them. One of the things that was suggested by this group of people who'd been meeting for several years was to look for a way to change the country that was not through bloodshed. Now, many of you know that in Central America, for many years, there were wars that were going on. Armed struggle, because there were military dictatorships, there was tremendous repression, tremendous inability of the people to have access to their country's resources. And so many felt that the only way was to try to overthrow the government through armed struggle. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. Well, in Honduras, these people were saying, how do we create a society in which the majority of our citizens can have education, can have enough to basically eat, can have a roof over our heads without having to take up arms and overthrow the government? So the idea came to look towards having a constitutional assembly. Okay, something we did at the birth of our nation, a constitutional assembly, to gather and to say, what is it? How do we want our country to be structured so that people have participation? And so this is what's been happening in South America. Many countries in South America in recent years have gone through this process, and it's led to changes in which people feel much more included in their governments. It's a change in which many of the natural resources of the country are now, instead of being sent those profits to other banks, to other corporations, are going into education and healthcare and so on. And so the idea from these people was, let's consult the people of Honduras and ask if they're interested in having this kind of a vote. That was scheduled for June 28th. Well, to make a long story short, that day never took place. The morning of June 28th, President Zelaya was sleeping in his home, and soldiers came at gunpoint and said they would either kill him or take him out of the country. They took him out of the country on an airplane and landed. He didn't know where he was, got out with his pajamas on the tarmac of the airport. They took off, and he was in the neighboring country of Costa Rica. The two generals that organized this overthrow are graduates of the School of the Americas. Quickly, things shifted in Honduras, and one thing led to another, and they put some other people in charge. They put the former president of the Congress in charge. The reason I share this is because many people think that, well, this place, this School of the Americas, a lot of the atrocities that took place there are of the past, but they're of the present. They're of right now. Because as we speak, the situation in Honduras continues to be very, very difficult. President Zelaya was not allowed to return. He tried to return, actually, on July 5th. He was coming to the country. That same day, I was coming to the country. I had called our friends in Honduras, whom we'd only recently met with, and said, what can we do? And they said, well, you know what you really can do? Come here. Come be with us, because by having the presence of someone from the U.S., we're going to be safer. And also, you can see what's happening. Immediately, there was a curfew. People were being detained by the thousands if they were out after the curfew. People were being beaten, tortured. And in the following weeks after the coup, there were 12 people that were killed. So we were asked to come to Honduras after this coup. And so I got online and bought a ticket to Honduras and said, I'm going to Honduras. That same day, I sent out the word, anybody who wants to come from the School of America's Watch movement, come with me. And sure enough, seven other people that day, including one person here from Oakland, decided to try to get to Honduras that day. Well, we were trying to get there the same day that President Zelaya was trying to get there. And as his plane attempted to land, the military sent tanks to block all the runways, and so he was not able to land. My own plane was diverted to El Salvador, the neighboring country, and when I went out the doors of the airport, feeling very frustrated, not knowing where I was going to stay, what I was going to do, I remember exiting, going out the doors, and all of a sudden there was a sea of people outside the door of the airport. I asked the people what they were doing there, and many of them had Romero, Monsignor Romero t-shirts. And I said, what's going on? I thought maybe it was like a conference, you know, maybe a Romero kind of conference or something. And they said, no, President Zelaya was supposed to land in Honduras and wasn't allowed to land, so he's coming here, and we've come to greet him. So this is the neighboring country who's coming to greet the president. And they said also four other presidents are coming. And so as I spoke with them, four other planes landed from other Latin American countries, Argentina, Paraguay, Ecuador, and then the president of El Salvador landed to greet the president. And some of those countries aren't from right around the corner. They're like 8-9 hours by plane. They're far away, and yet they came to join this crowd. I think what's important about that moment at that crowd, and again, the people in their Romero t-shirts, why were they called to be there? Again, a call, I think, of that faith to at least come to the airport, to be present for this president who could not return to his own country, and so perhaps in the name of his countrymen who were waiting for him to be there to greet him. It's also testimony to a different moment in Latin America where there's a real sense of connection, a connecting between the countries. That's a really important and very powerful moment right now. This situation in Honduras continues to evolve. President Zelaya, only 2 days ago or a day and a half ago, actually returned to Venezuela, to Honduras. This time he didn't come by a plane. We don't know quite how he got there. He came through the mountains and the rivers and the back roads in the company of some other people. And he's currently in the Brazilian embassy in the capital of Honduras. The Honduran government, the people who have led the coup, have sent people, the military, to repress the people who went to the embassy to greet him and shot tear gas and rubber bullets, and there's many injured and being detained as we speak. So this situation again continues to evolve, but what's important again to see that this issue of the School of the Americas is not an issue of the past, it's an issue of the present. I kind of want to end it with a story. I liked something that was said earlier on about how this talk is not to try to dish all people who are in the military. And I'm going to tell the story of actually a military man that I met in Honduras. And I think it's a testimony of how we are called to go forward with our lives and take steps that can lead to helping others. And interestingly enough, he's a graduate of the School of the Americas. When I was in Honduras in April, I was invited to have a dinner with some friends. So we went to the apartment, and as we were going up the steps, the friend that we knew said, "Oh, I want to introduce you to my brother, Hernan. This is Lisa. Oh, hi." And she said, "Oh, by the way, he's a graduate of the School of the Americas." And I'm like, "Oh, hi, Hernan." You know, kind of like feeling creepy. And I'm like, "I'm going to have dinner in this small group." Well, he began to talk. We ended up talking 2 hours in the street. He told his story. He, as a young man, at this point he's probably about 60, had actually wanted to go to the seminary. But he couldn't get in the seminary. I don't know why he couldn't. So he decided to join the military. Wanted to do something of service to his country. That's why he joined the military, to be of service. With a lot of problems, he was from a very humble family, was, like a lot of other people who were sent to the military officer school, beaten and not treated too well. But he was then sent to train at the School of the Americas. One of the things he learned was how to then target people in his own community, in the city he was living, anybody who was trying to bring change to their country. It was under military dictatorship, whether organizing a group of students, a group of in the community, organize farmers, they were the enemy. They were to be seen as the enemy, and they were to be dealt with. They were to be disappeared. They were to be killed. So those are the orders, to disappear people. So he said, "I was given the names of the people I was supposed to disappear. So for example, Juan Almendra." He said, "I would do some detective work and find out where Juan Almendra was. I'd go get Juan Almendra. I'd drive to the Nicaraguan border and I'd say, 'Okay, Juan, desaparezcate, disappear.'" In other words, flee, okay? He said, "Sometimes I'd even bring him to my house and my wife would give him a good lunch before I sent him off." Okay, imagine. He was found out. He was captured by the old military. He was beaten, tortured, imprisoned, and then exiled from his own country for 10 years. A few years ago, a man from Canada went to track him down and found him. And he said, "Do you remember me?" And he said, "No." He said, "I was one of the ones you took to the border and said, 'Desaparezcate,' okay, disappear." He went on to Canada, became a member of Amnesty International and a member of Parliament. And he went back to search for Hernan, and they're actually writing a book together. But I tell this story because, again, the story's not of bad people, of bad military. The people of Hernan who went to say at the SOA are as good as people as you and I, as Romero. You know, they did not go to do bad things to their fellow citizens. But it is our structure, our institutions, that have turned them often into somebody who they really not do not want to be and have to turn around and commit atrocities against their own people. Some have been brave enough, such as Hernan, to say no and to pay the consequences for it. So as we have the heroes, those who have lost their lives by graduates of the School of the Americas, there are those who've also said no to receiving this training and to carrying out. I think it's important that we remember them.
You're listening to Lisa Sullivan on tour recently in the San Francisco Bay Area. This event was for students at Holy Names University in Oakland, California. Here are the details of the School of America Watch.
Every November, the weekend before Thanksgiving, many, many, many people gather at the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, about 20,000. And it's usually about 10,000 college students from around the country. I think probably just about every state is represented. It began from that tree climb of Roy and then a hunger fast of 10 people, but more and more people feel called to stand up to call for the closing of this school. And so we gather that weekend. We do a lot of things. We have workshops, concerts. It's an amazing time to learn a lot. But on Sunday morning, we gather at the gates of Fort Benning. And behind us is the School of the Americas, and in front is the sea of 10,000 people. And people bring a symbol. Often it's a cross, or perhaps a star, or a flower, or a butterfly, with one of the names of the victims of the graduates, somebody who has been murdered, who has lost their life at the hands of the graduates of this school. And so, quite simply, someone sings out the names, one by one, of these people. Oscar Romero says their age, and the whole crowd lifts up their symbol, if it's a cross, whatever, and sings out, "Presente," okay? In Latin America, when somebody's been killed, we often call out their name in a loud voice. We say, you know, Pedro, and we all call out presente. It's a way of saying you are still present here among us. For me, going to this event, even though I had lived in Latin America for so long and I'd been to many peace rallies and that kind of thing, nothing really prepared me for the emotion that I felt at the gate of Fort Benning. And the first time I went, I actually went with my daughter Maya. I think she was 17 at that point. And she had lived her entire life in Latin America. And she's standing at the gate with this school that had caused so much atrocity, so much loss of life on one side. But in front of her, she's looking at the crowd of 20,000. And she said to me, she said, Mom, most of these people who've come here, they've probably not even been to Latin America. She said, but feel their love. You know, they've come here out of love for us in Latin America. It's that power of love that you feel at that moment in the face of the power of evil, but you feel like it is that power of love that will overcome the other. And so I invite you to consider coming down. It's a very amazing and actually hopeful and inspirational moment in which we remember just calling out the names.
Lisa goes on now to describe the latest issue of School of the America Watch's newsletter, Presente, and tells the story of the young man on the cover of this issue.
So on the cover of Presente, this issue is a young Honduran man. His name is Isis Obe Murillo, from a town about 6 hours outside of Tegucigalpa, the capital. He's one of nine children, 19 years old, was first year in the university. Worked part-time at a supermarket. And the day that I was trying to get to Honduras, July 5th, the day that President Zelaya was trying to return to the airport, came 100,000 Hondurans to greet their president, and he was one of them. Came from very far away. And so as he came and the crowds came from within the airport, the military was stationed. At one point, they turned and just shot into the crowd. And so Isis lost his life that day on July 5th. That weekend in November, we'll be remembering Isis and all the victims, the most recent victims of the graduates of the school.
You're listening to Lisa Sullivan on Raising San Radio, KZSU FM 90.1. And Lisa's going to go on and describe the SOA, the School of Americas, is not the only such school that does this kind of training, albeit the most elite.
The School of Americas trains only Latin American troops because the classes are in Spanish, and there are other schools geared towards African countries and Asian countries, and we're aware that even Latin American training also takes place in other places. What does happen with the School of the Americas for Latin America, though, it's kind of like the Harvard or Yale of military training schools, in that those who study there often take leadership roles in their military, and so that's one of the reasons why we focused. But it's clear that it's not the only difficulty, yeah. It was created a long time ago. It was created in 1948, and it was when there was a whole conflict in the, you know, there was between those countries that considered themselves communist and the U.S. and other countries, and so it was really created to stop the spread of communism, and it was established in Panama. But even as the, quote, communist threat disappeared, the school remained. And so in some ways, the reason for its creation is no longer there, but it became a kind of convenient tool to train troops who would then, in Latin America, carry out the interests of, I would say, not so much the citizens of the United States, more the corporations of the United States, you know, to make big business, make it safe for big business and for interest of big economic interests. And so, but it is a school that trains, that military counterinsurgency, interrogation tactics, military intelligence, use of arms, a number of different, there's not just one course, there's a number of different courses that are taught there. One thing that the people who want to close this school are doing is trying to do it in one of three ways. One is, like I said before, attrition, get countries to not send them. Okay, that's the part I'm working on. The other part from up here, there's two parts. One is through Congress. There is a bill that is being presented in Congress to close the school by taking away the funds and investigating it. And so one of the things that we're asking people is to call or to write a letter or email to your representative asking them to sponsor this bill. It's called Bill 2567, H.R. 2567. And the other part is through executive order. And so there's been a petition that tens of thousands of people have signed asking President Obama to close it down.
There was Lisa Sullivan on the School of the Americas and the ongoing effort to close it down through the School of America Watch. Get involved by visiting the website soaw.org or subscribing to Presente, which is also available through the website soaw.org. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse reports that Honduran de facto leaders and deposed President Manuel Zelaya have agreed to restart talks, although Zelaya and de facto leader Robert Micheletti would not meet face-to-face for now. Honduras, meanwhile, faces legislative and presidential elections on November 29th. And that's our show for this week. As usual, opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and not Stanford University or KZSU. Visit our website, RaisingSandRadio.org, to download any of our previous shows, and or you can also contact me at Susan@RaisingSandRadio.org. Tune in next week when we'll be talking with Peter Singer of the Brookings Institute. He's the author of Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, and his latest book, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Let's go out again with Che, the song, or Hasta Siempre, Comandante.
Aprendimos a quererte desde la histórica altura donde el sol de tu bravura le puso cerco a la muerte. Aquí se queda la clara de la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Y fuerte sobre la historia dispara cuando todo Santa Clara se despierta para verte. Aquí se queda la clara que la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Plantar la bandera con la luz de tu sonrisa. Aquí se queda la clara que la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Donde esperan la firmeza de tu brazo libertario. Aquí se queda la clara de la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara. Seguir.